have to fill some of those positions to make sure this moves forward.
Mustafa, let me ask you very quickly about what's happening today in Arizona. Members of the San Carlos Apache Nation have called a day of action in opposition to a proposed copper mine in a sacred portion of the Tonto National Forest, the tribe saying the planned mine would raise an ancient forest known as Oak Flat and contaminate a large swath of southern Arizona. The Trump administration racing to approve the mine as part of a massive transfer of federal land to oil, gas and mining companies in the final days of the Trump's presidency. What about these final days and what Trump is attempting to do?
We have to stay focused. They have continued to impact, you know, our federal lands just so folks can do additional mining. These are traditional lands. There is a cultural connection there. People have to continue to engage to fight back. You know, folks have been also going through legal challenges on many of these actions. We just have to continue to put a spotlight on it. And when the new administration comes in, they're going to have to use every tool that they have to reverse many of these decisions that will have long-term historical impacts in vulnerable communities across our country.
Mustafa Ali, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Former longtime head of the Environmental Justice Program at the Environmental Protection Agency, now Vice President of the National Wildlife Federation. Thank you so much for joining us today. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Perk, Dean Augusta, Libby Rene, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste.
Good morning. You're listening to More Talk Radio on your community radio station, KBOO.FM. This is Monday, December 21st, 2020. I'm Cecil Press, and I will be joined, or am joined, by our co-host, Celeste Perry.
I think I'm on. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, good. That's all that matters. I think if you can hear me, we can fake it. Good morning. Good morning. Yes. Welcome to another week of talk radio. And, you know, this is More Talk Radio. I heard you introducing the year.
It's 2020, a few more days of 2020, and you know, today is the great conjunction day, or not only is it winter solstice, but we have this special thing happening with Saturn and Jupiter today.
Yeah, if we can see it, I think we're still forecast for rain, so we might have to watch it recorded or if we're fortunate, real time from some other location. I do want to see this great conjunction. I remember other times in my life having seen astrological conjunctions and whatnot in the air and in the sky, marveling at how bright something would appear. And I figured this would really be lovely. I've seen some of the lunar eclipses and some of the other astrological occurrences in the past couple of years. I think I saw Neil Wise. I know I saw Hell Bop. That was such a big thing. And I think I saw Neil Wise. I don't remember, though, because, well, it's been a year, you know. And there are times when either the spectacle of some other disaster kind of supplanted the memory, or the mundane aspects of just trying to get through all of this upheaval kind of probably erased it. That's the only thing I can think of. But
for comparison, there was a great conjunction back in 2000, but the two planets were separated by about two full moon widths. This year, mm-hmm. the orbits bring them to where they appear to be about one-fifth of a full moon diameter. And so people are encouraged, if you may be in a place, the next time they will get close together in our skies won't be for another 60 years. So this is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime event for many people. In fact, the last time they got this close together was...
800 years ago? Was it?
It was in 1623.
Okay.
But it's really difficult, if not impossible, to see them because they appear much closer to the sun and set soon after it. So we have to go back another 400 years to 1226. This time would have been the last time that they would have had a good view of this type of conjunction. So if you're in a space place, you know, look in your southern hemisphere and southwest horizon and see Saturn.
Right about sunset.
Yeah.
Well, you know, good luck to all of those who have that opportunity. Also, I know the last astrological, or actually this would be in a celestial effect more so than astrological, was a couple of weeks ago, the solar flare would have produced aurora borealis, and we should have been at the latitude to see it, but, well, it was cloudy. And the skies are still cloudy all day. What can I say? But, you know.
And, you know, we have a worldwide audience, so people aren't just situated in the Pacific Northwest. So somewhere, someone might be seeing this.
True that. You know, but, you know, the sky and the clouds are going to be clearing. In a sense, this is totally metaphorical, y'all, you know, for the Portland and Pacific Northwest area, but specifically in the Oregon area, the skies will be clearing in a metaphorical sense, in that our respective congresses are going to be meeting. So the Oregon legislature is meeting today in-house, in person. Isn't that a violation of COVID COVID restrictions to have that many people in the same room, in the same building? But
it's interesting. If you have observed some of the special sessions this year in terms of how they are conducting business and keeping their distance, and it's somewhat different than for the Senate than the House. You know, there are more legislators in the House, but you will see in the Senate that they are fairly distant, and so I think they are practicing good health practices as they do the work that we are calling them to do.
I like the way you said that we're calling them to do, because that is it. And so what I mean when I say the sky's clearing of a sort is that the legislature is going to address some extra needs for stimulus, financial support, or I guess I should say economic support for the state, for the Oregonians here who are having issues with rent and other things. And I'm wondering if they're going to also address issues for restaurants and bars, especially like those who want to have alcohol to go. And also they will be addressing some other supports for small businesses. But I find it fascinating that we're going to hear from them, and then we're also supposed to get a check for COVID support from the federal government. And here is something. I don't know if I'm the only person that's ever noticed this, but I usually run my television with closed captions on for a lot of reasons. One is I want to make sure that I heard what's going on, and sometimes I try to simultaneously read as well as hear what's being broadcast to make sure I catch it. And then sometimes it's just because you can't always understand what people say. And I found it interesting that often when I'm running my closed caption programming and on TV for anything, every now and then what's captured and put out is not the same as what was said. And it was really interesting because I was watching the KGW broadcast this morning that talked about the COVID check, the $600 COVID check that we're supposed to be getting. And it said the $600 stimulus check. That was what was said. However, what the closed caption said is the $600 stingy check. And I thought to myself, yeah, that's about right. That sounds about right, because what are you going to do with $600? But anyway, we kind of want to address this particular aspect of the economic support and what have you that's coming down the pike, both from the federal and the state legislatures, and ask, if you were at this Monday session, what would you say to our state legislatures about what we actually need from them in terms of COVID support? Would the sanctions, or not sanctions, well, help me, Lord, would the measures that they're taking to help small businesses, to help renters, to help the small landlords, small local landlords, et cetera, be enough? Or the things that you think that should cover that haven't been considered? You know, what is the message you would like them to hear? And then here we are with $600 coming from our magnanimous federal government, and bear in mind that's your tax money, you know, because that's where they get that money. They don't get it from anybody else except the people and the businesses. And as we know, some businesses and some people, like our president, don't pay that much. So most of us listening are paying the bulk of it. Is that $600 going to make a difference to you? You know, I'm thinking $600 might put food on the table, or you might pay an electricity bill. What was that your research started up, Cecil, about it actually paying rent?
Well, yes, the $600 will not cover the cost of rent in any state for a one-bedroom apartment. And the closest, I think, is Oklahoma, where the average is $650 for a month's rent for a one-bedroom apartment. So you are correct. The $600 will, we all know, will not go very far. And so you might be able to buy some food as you sit on the curb under your car.
I won't be under my car. I'll be in my car. But you know what's funny about that is $600 will buy food, but it won't buy takeout food. And so we can't support our local businesses with a $600 stimulus check. So it's kind of like a no-win situation.
So let's hear from some of the thoughts that you have. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Do you have proposals for the state legislature in terms of what they can do in this? I think it's the third special session this year, but it's a one-day special session. And what are your reflection on the proposed, I do not think they have voted yet, compromise legislation from the U.S. Congress, $600. Again, our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. And here in Oregon, Governor Kate Brown has asked the legislature to address a few items that Celeste shared. One including relief for landlord and tenants, a bill that would protect schools from coronavirus-related lawsuits, and Celeste mentioned this, even a provision to legalize to-go cocktails as a way to support bars and restaurants. The bills, the biggie in the bill for the renters' protection is the state would create a fund that would let some landlords recoup up to 80% of the money that they lost because renters can afford to pay. And the bill would also free up landlords a bit in terms of eviction. Essentially, it would allow eviction in more cases that have been allowed so far during this pandemic. So people are keeping an eye on this. Clearly, this is not popular with most landlords, and I'm sure tenant advocates are also concerned by what's in this legislation that the governor has proposed.
Yeah, I can appreciate.
Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Our numbers are 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Give us a call. And then what I was going to say is I can appreciate that the landlords are upset that, you know, they may be losing that 20%, and, you know, that they feel, well, as it was articulated in some of the news articles I heard, that they felt that the renters should not get off without having to pay anything. And I'm thinking to myself, renters who are not paying rent are not paying rent because we assume, in all honesty, that they can't afford it, that they actually don't have the money. So I'm wondering, what is it these landlords want? What's the proverb or the homily? You can't get blood from a turnip or a stone, whatever.
Yep.
You know, and right. I'm wondering, what is their solution? Do they feel like these people should be carrying forward this debt? Now, I confess, I'm not a landlord, so I might think differently if I was, you know. And I know the burden that rent has posed for me, you know, on occasions, and trying to manage rent and debt and, you know, food in a deficit situation is distressing. That's the least of it, you know, but it's distressing.
Yeah,
so I don't know what people are expecting, but maybe some small level landlords will share their concerns. And by small level, I mean you only have maybe two or three units. You know, I think they said one to two units in the news. So maybe you could share your insight about that too. But phone numbers, you know, let's get it popping. It's 503-231-8187.
Well, it occurred to me, Celeste, that 80% is better than nothing, and
that's what I was thinking.
But but we'll see. And also, you know, nationwide, the unemployment continues to rise. And almost last month, almost a million people applied for unemployment. So we have a long way to go. You know, there's this two vaccines who are now out there, but I heard that for most of the populations, they will not be able to get vaccinated until maybe sometime in the summer or early fall. So
right.
This will continue to impact us for many, many more months to go.
Well, you know, and if we're talking about in the summer or spring or some such, you know, date, that is with the expectation that there won't be any other challenges regarding both the dissemination of the vaccine and the efficacy of the vaccine. If the vaccine proves to have any side effects, which will make people leery of taking it and slow the dissemination of it, that will cause, you know, us to still be in this lockdown or prohibition or whatever fashion that you you want to call it. It will cause people not to take it and us to possibly be in lockdown for another year, into the end of 2021.
Yeah, it will be a time. Again, our number 503-231-8187. And Celeste, you mentioned, I think it was off the air, about the concerns about the legislators, the lawmakers meeting in person. And I read an OPB report where they say it's a good question, you know, at times when we're being asked to stay home to reduce the spread of the coronavirus, why are the people meeting in person? And Dirk Vanderhaar responded by saying that the state has never done an all-remote legislative session, although the Constitution allows that kind of session. But the governor ultimately decided on an in-person session. Though the lawmakers will be in the Capitol today, they will be conducting virtual hearings most of the time, and only coming into the chambers to pass bills. And there will be a lot of social distancing in that place. So that's what they will be doing in Salem today. A lot of work.
All right. Well, you know, yay for social distancing. I found it ironic when I was listening to one of the legislative representatives saying that, well, it's important for them to meet in person because, as he characterized it, we can't have people all over the state or even all over the country making laws about Oregon, and, you know, because it's really important for them to be there. And I thought, that's irrelevant where you are. What's relevant is where your head is at and where your vote is at, you know. But, you know, that's a whole nother story. You know, that's one of those weird tangential aspects of life right now in 2020. But as we wait for callers to call in at 503-231-8187, discuss, you know, the points we brought up, I want to throw out another little piece of kind of anecdotal and tangential information. It's ironic that that $600, and I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to quote the closed caption on KGW, and I'm going to say that $600 stingy check is coming from the feds. I find it ironic that Trump wanted to give us $2,000 at one point, and that his aides were saying, oh, no, that's too much money. Don't give him that. And I'm wondering, What was the thought process behind that little dynamic? Was it that was giving too much to the people and conceding too much to the Democrats? You know, because $2,000 makes a whole lot more sense than $600. And if the whole idea is to boost our economy, how different is that than lowering interest rates? How different is that than bailing out banks and car manufacturers and, oh, I don't know, some of these other businesses that have gotten money? Is it the $6 billion, or is it the billion rather? Is it the billion amount that made it? Was it $900 billion? Is it the $900 billion that the amount, is that what's scary? Because I find it really interesting that's the one thing that I've heard him say in this whole COVID situation that actually made sense and could be effective and was beneficial, and yet those close to him politically, the aides, were saying, no, don't do that. Now, I mean, the only thing I can think of is that it conceded too much leverage to the Democrats.
Well, it's some of the concerns, I think you are correct. Some of the discussions that happened was a concern. They wanted to keep it under $1 trillion for somehow that was a magic breaking point for the Republicans. And of course, 6 months ago, the House passed a multi-trillion dollar second stimulus bill, but the U.S. Senate did not act upon it. As you stated, the proposed legislation, and they haven't voted on it yet, will have the stinginess checks of $600 to individuals. The jobless would receive a $300 weekly federal enhancements and benefits for 11 weeks from the end of December through mid-March under this deal. And again, now the amount is half of the earlier federal boost, which ran out in July. That was $600. The Paycheck Protection Program would reopen so that the hardest hit small businesses can apply for a second loan. And I hope by small businesses they don't mean some of those companies. I saw some of the mega churches got small business loans, and some other businesses who aren't, I don't consider them small, would qualify, but $12 billion will be designated for minority-owned and very small businesses. And unlike the CARES Act, which carved out $15 billion for live venues, independent movie theaters, and cultural institutions, it also expands eligibility to more nonprofits, such as local newspapers, TV, and radio broadcasters. So there's a lot in there. SNAP benefits would increase by 15% for 6 months, but would not expand eligibility, and it will include funding for vaccine funding so that people might be able to get a vaccine.
Arthur's on the line.
Well let's go to our caller.
Yeah, let's go to Arthur, who has something to say.
Good morning.
Hello there, Cecil Sleff. Can you hear me okay?
Good morning.
Yes, you can.
Okay. I'm in subsidized housing myself, and I appreciate being able to afford the lower rent. But money is not on the top of my list of the solutions. If we only had enough money, you know? If we just found some way to get it out of someone else's pocket or bank account and put it into another, and then we could afford to live. And that's like for healthcare, I wanted to say that right now, really, during the pandemic, is the time for health care reform, and not just to be able to afford it, but to be able to have a system, build a system of a kind that would serve everyone and reduce the chances of diseases that are happening now from occurring again. It's not the matter of money. And it's the same way money is not the solution for housing. It's like a right, and not just a right, but a system of keeping us from getting in at each other's throats all the time. And can you see where I'm going in the direction here? You understand what I'm saying?
Well, go ahead and continue, because I'm not quite. I mean, I hear what you're saying about in terms of insurance. You health insurance. You need it to be addressed in a way that doesn't make it so hyper competitive, and that we also need our various needs like housing versus food versus medical care not to be competitive. Is that what you're saying?
That's pretty close to it. It's just the beginning, really, because subsidized housing, the full amount is goes to the landlord, so the landlord is secure having rental apartments.
Yes. Yeah.
And when the economy goes down as completely as it is now, is the landlord going to say, how am I going to get my money? And who do I have to push out of housing in order to? It's like our system is not structured very well, and it is structured to benefit the people who are most secure in their incomes and how we live. So I say we can't go back to business as usual. Our American society and societies around the world that are industrialized, we are so wasteful, so. The way we live and how we get around it. So it's harmful to the environment, and it's unjust, and people come up, not everyone, but our leaders say, well, if we only had enough money, then our system would be better. But no.
It's more than money.
I think the health care is that one thing. I think that we it's not the money for the health care, it's how the health care system works. Have we got a system that would work even if it was affordable? I said, no, we don't. And our leaders, including our unfortunately reelected mayor, they're not going to do anything about it. They're not going to do anything about homelessness. They're not.
You mentioned several things, Arthur, in terms of health care, and I think that's a valid point. And what they can do, and then you shifted over to the mayor and homelessness, and that's a different field to operate.
Well, it's a healthcare system. It's living out in the streets is murder. It's guaranteed death out there to live that way.
That's true. But one of the challenges is I understand what you're saying in terms of it doesn't seem like any level of government is addressing the needs. But unfortunately, the way this country is set up, the feds. Thing is the business of housing.
Okay, that's pretty close there. Can I just leave you with that direction for the conversation to take? I think it's...
Well, I mean, I don't want to limit the conversation to that direction, but I do welcome other calls along those same lines for sure. Because that is one of the concerns. I mean, you know, the reason health care costs so much in this country is because of the business of health care and the fact that private industry doesn't want to give up its monopoly of how health care has been commodified and disseminated, and that they want there to be the highest profit return on investment, or not highest profit, but the highest profit return on investment possible which means then that it has to be this artificially hyper competitive dynamic that we have that causes consumers to be pitted against each other and governments to be pitted against each other in terms of producing some kind of economic process to get us health care. It doesn't have to be the system that we have, and other industrialized countries have showed us that. But, well, we're greedy over here in the United States, and that's how we roll.
Well,
I mean, you know, there it is.
And but, you know, as it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have
no,
to
it
be.
No, it doesn't have to be. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're groping in the dark, blindly trying to figure out some kind of healthcare system. Other countries have shown us the way. You know, and yes, maybe our taxes would be higher, but here's the thing. If my taxes were properly spent and all of our needs were met without concern about our artificially induced class, you know, system or caste system, if you want, then we could be satisfied with the fact that we actually might have a little less money in our pockets, but all of our needs were met. But no, that's not the American way. That sounds like socialism, and we can't have that.
But, you know, interestingly enough, I don't know if you noticed, while you and Arthur were speaking a few minutes ago, I got another call, and so I put you on hold while I picked up this other call because I noticed it was from my doctor's office, and they had questions about billing my insurance, and I said, oh, I can't talk right now, but, you know, it's all like, ooh. So,
yeah. Yep, there it is. There mm-hmm. it is. And that's, you know, that's our reality here in the States. You know, everything is, and I'm going to use this phrase again, everything is hyper competitive. There is no reason for this level of commodification and competition in the marketplace for our basic needs. And
basic
I feel,
needs.
Arthur, on
yeah.
that. You know,
yes.
It's like we should have a right to housing, and there should be a rent control instituted. And the problem is everybody wants more money on their investment, and it's like, okay, I feel you. But, you know, when you think about housing and how none of us, not one of us, can get by without housing, and we need quality housing, that should
yes.
not be something that's commodified to the extent that
right.
it is.
Ravi's
right.
on.
And
we have Ravi on the line.
Okay. You're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Join us in our conversation at 503-231-8187. And good morning, Ravi. You're on there.
Thank you. Good morning. Yeah. This is actually my first time listening and calling in. But,
thank you.
You know, sure. And so it's exciting to actually be a part of the conversation. I've worked for 20 years as a federal contractor, so I have a lot of kind of insight on how government makes its decisions. And I guess the question that's been on my mind, if we know we have a broken system, you know, we often in engineering talk about an as-is state and a to-be state. And that's mm-hmm. where I keep scouring the internet and talking to people and going to events, and I never see what the to-be state is. And I wonder if you have or if that could be part of the conversation. You know, what would the better way look like for healthcare, for example? And who are the right people to be in that conversation? Are they doctors, nurses? Are they, you know, academics? You know, I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm also curious in your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, I haven't been a federal contractor myself, probably not as many years as you. I know that sometimes they will bring a diverse group of participants to the table to discuss this, but the ultimate consideration really comes from our government, and then the government is highly influenced by lobbyists. So these lobbyists who represent whatever corporation or entity that has the most money to pay for them is going to determine, you know, the to-be process, really. You know, but I'm curious, like Cecil said, what is your ideal setup?
I'm a practitioner of what they call agile methodology. It is, you know, basically it says that the people who are doing the work have the best knowledge. And personally, I would, you know, develop a community of practice amongst people, the folks who are actually doing the work inside of a hospital, and patients, and sort of get like a focus group together, or maybe a large focus group, and just say, look, mm-hmm. what do you need? And how can we best serve that? And just cut out the middlemen, the red tape, and all the extra process that's been artificially inserted, to your point, in order to fund the capitalist agenda. You know, we can eliminate that middleman and the extra work and just get patients talking directly to nurses and doctors about what care should look like.
All right.
Go ahead, Cecil.
I was just going to ask, what do you think is preventing that from happening? Because there's pressures against what I see as a reasonable solution you offer, Ravi.
The challenge is, honestly, as someone once said, the only fear we have is fear itself, right? I think that, you know, in my experience, I reshaped, like, as an example, I was requested to reshape a leadership team, 10 individuals, all at least 5 years older than me, yet I coached them through, okay, let's go back to the roots, let's go back to why, for example, healthcare exists in the first place, and then satisfy that need. And I think that the reason it doesn't get done is, quite frankly, it's overwhelming. I mean, when people think about healthcare, they don't think about the city that they live in, they think about the entire nation. And there's no reason why one city's healthcare has to operate exactly like another city's healthcare. You know, every city and every town and every community is different. And I think if people start thinking about healthcare on a local level instead of as this giant national program, if they think about it locally, it won't be so overwhelming.
Well, I would throw a monkey wrench in that thinking.
Okay.
To a degree, and an analogy would be our driving rules nationwide. Each state may have slightly different driving rules, but there are certain things that I think and I would have to double check with this, but there are certain things that I think the Department of Transportation has mandated must be universal from state to mm-hmm. state. And,
yeah, and I agree with that. I see where you're going. I think that I call it guidance versus rules. Like, the federal uh-huh. should provide guidance, but rules maybe are made more locally.
Or maybe we might think of a policy that could be amended. But, I mean, for one thing, I think nationwide there should be certain there should be some not the bottom of the barrel minimums established, you know, minimum policies or guidelines for care. You know, I think that states that don't have enough money need to have the guarantee that there would be a federal assistance in helping them meet those minimum guidelines. Because we know that with the conversations we've been having with the Trump idea or the Trump Republicans' idea of economy, that some of these quote-unquote liberal or blue states bring in more money than some of the red states. And
right.
So we know that that dynamic happens whether it is politicized or not. You know, it's just a fact of our economy and where business and manufacturing and people are. And so there should be some federal support or an oversight to make sure that these less able states, less financially viable states can make this happen. But I mean, to a degree, I do agree with you, because the states with more rural populations are going to have different needs. But there's no reason why they can't have the same level of service that the more populated and more prosperous states have. You know, I don't want to see there be any difference that way, because, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind, being a woman of color, is separate but equal, you know, and it's like, no, right. That never did happen either. But I can see your point. Here's another challenge, though. I'm not sure that it should be necessarily all of the doctors involved, and I think it should be healthcare practitioners at all levels, and I think it should be maybe weighted a little heavier with consumers, because I'm just going to say it, the higher level of education and aspiration that medical practitioners have, sometimes the more elitist they become.
They're out of touch.
Their views.
A little. Yeah.
Hmm.
I was just sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. But yeah, I was going to say they're out of touch. I find that to be a big problem. I mean, it happens in software. You have leaders that haven't done the work in a while, and they're out of touch, and they push the wrong agenda. And that's one of the things I've been coaching with. You know, I'm on a program of hundreds of people. So I talked to hundreds of developers, testers, analysts, you know, the people who do the work, and I talked to a lot of customers on the government side. And the thing I learned the most is that the better you understand the customer, we create these things called personas. It's literally like a mini bio on what a patient in this case would be. So, John, you know,
profile.
Yes, it's a profile, exactly. And so you keep editing that profile the more and more people you talk to, but at least you have one sort of target that a doctor could look at and say, ah, that represents, you know, the typical patient. And then you have more at-risk patients, you have people like me who hardly ever go to the doctor, but, you know, you start to understand the full breadth of patient needs by looking at, you know, talking to different people. So I 100% agree with you. Most of the focus needs to be on patients, you know, and what we would call end users.
And here's another thing, that one reason that I feel like there should be some national oversight. Now, this is something that is coming to light, and it's not as hotly contested as it might have been, say, a decade or two ago. And that is the effect that racism has on health, especially for minorities. And, you know, some years ago, this condition called metabolic syndrome was discovered, and it was publicized, and it became apparent that one of the reasons why you find a lot of minorities of color overweight and with high blood pressure and diabetes is not necessarily because of diet, but because of the fight or flight response, and that's kind of being a little reductionist, but that's not entirely reductionist. That's essentially, you know, kind of what it is. You know, that effect and how it produces results in the body, like insulin resistance and high cholesterol and hypertension. And so until we can really get a grip on how we treat people in this country, you're going to have a segment of the population that's going to be a high-level consumer of health without necessarily having a poor lifestyle, but just having to deal with the stress of being other in this country. And there are a lot of people, you know, who have developed diabetes and hypertension and high cholesterol, who are maintaining a healthy diet and do try to get some exercise, but this living under this condition is debilitating. So that's another reason why I look at having a diverse mix of participants in this, because you need the people who are savvy to that population's needs.
Right, and I think there's a lot of churn going on with the social justice movements, and I would be, you know, I would be asking some of those folks, you know, some of the folks who have been most outspoken about change, you know, to use that to our advantage and say, okay, you want change? Let's talk about it. Let's talk about healthcare, you know, and you know, you could go down the whole gamut. We're talking about Federal Health and Human Services, right? HHS. That department would probably be, you know, have some of that oversight and guidance. But then, you know, you've got your list of how many departments there are in the federal government and then how many agencies. That alone is another trigger point for me. You don't need departments. Mm-hmm. You just need the agencies. Why do you have these large bureaucratic oversight within federal of paper pushers, for example?
You're taking us down a little bit of a more microscopic level than we're really prepared to go today. And you have brought up some very excellent points, and I hope you're part of some community effort to get these points out beside, you know, talk radio, because people could benefit from hearing this. But I do want to open us up to potentially some other calls in the few minutes we have left. But I really thank you for, you know, just clarifying the need for us to look at our government and, you know, on both federal and state level and retooling how we address our needs, our personal needs.
Yes, exactly. And I was only just pointing out that there are many, many challenges, but one at a time. Is what I found. Yes. It is feasible. So I just want to put that out there. Like, large and lofty goals are possible. But thank you so much for you know, giving me the opportunity to speak. And I love what you're saying. That's inspiring me. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And you are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. I'm here with my colleague, Cecil Prescott. And we're talking about the the stingy check.
the stingy check.
Man, I don't think I'm going to get over that. That's probably what I'm going to call it, you know, from now on, because that just summed it up so appropriately for me, you know. Go ahead.
You know, where our neighbors, like, you know, the country just north of us, you know, have been ensuring that their citizens have a livable wage, but a more livable appropriation from their federal governments monthly. You know, here in the United States, we were thrilled with $1,200 one time, as opposed to a $2,000 every month. And for those who were listening to Democracy Now! This morning, they recorded Senator from Vermont speaking on the Senate floor, advocating, as he does so well, in terms of a certain generosity, or not necessarily generosity, but realistic approach to how you might meet the needs of the people in the United States. And as you and Robbie discussed, there are different ways of doing things that bring in more people as part of the conversation and approach these issues from what are the needs of the community, rather than a sense of how can we be as stingy as possible while we ensure the welfare of corporations and those who can afford to pay and influence legislators.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, let's get real. we have a president who has paid just barely more tax than we're getting in this stingy bill. And
oh, how many more days? How many more days before they drag him out the White House?
31 days?
Maybe 30, it's the 20th of January, right?
So maybe I thought it was
31. 20th. No, the 20th of January, I said,
yeah.
Inauguration.
Oh, I thought you said the, okay, yeah. So the 20th, and today is the 21st, so, you know, we got roughly 10 days, so that's why I said 31 days.
And 30, yeah, month left.
Thomas
How
is on the line.
More damage?
We have Thomas.
Okay. Good morning, Thomas.
Yeah, hi. Well, I just wanted to bring up this little fact that I came across on the internet. Johns Hopkins University, their medical school or management, did a study in 2016. This can be looked up on the internet because that's what I did. I just looked it up. And they said that, and this is hard to believe, that in hospitals every year, there are about 5,000 people killed per week. Per week. That's 250,000 people a year. And these are preventable things. These aren't people that are just dying from their injuries or a disease or something, but, you know, a misapplication of procedures or medications and things like that. And that's just in the hospital. So that system, the medical system, to me, because it's embedded and run as a for-profit, and I know, Celeste, you kind of stumbled on the word socialism, but to me, that's part of the brainwashing.
I didn't stumble. I was laughing. yeah,
I know. I understand that, but okay, so you made a joke about it, but it's the word that really should be out in front is capitalism, and that's
well,
the
yes,
way,
indeed.
And you... You know, that's the way the hospitals are being run. How can all of these very good people, the hospital workers, who are sacrificing themselves to take care of all of these very sick people in this crisis, and the doctors and all of those people, how can they have an outcome that kills 250,000 people a year? Well, it's the way it's run. Because under this capitalistic system, you know, there are other countries like... Sweden, they're capitalists too, but they have a more of a social bent in their culture and their society that allows them a little more concern about those kinds of outcomes, so they don't have the bad outcomes. And I think that's what should be pointed at. It should be pointed at those medical corporations, the pharmaceutical corporations. They're the ones that are giving us the bad outcome, because we have good workers. You know, with not with the means, though, because they won't allocate funding to the hospitals to have a lot of beds, to have a lot of backup systems and medications and things like that, so we fall behind. So it's right. To me, it's I don't want to defend that system, but we have to take care of the people. And to me, it's Medicare for all, you know, single payer. And that's not socialized medicine, that's socialized insurance. A lot of people get that wrong. It has, you'll still have free choice of doctors and hospitals and all of that sort of thing. You can keep your same doctors. And people are afraid of it because it's socialism, ha, ha, ha. You know? I mean,
there you go.
Right.
Yes, I feel you right there. Thank you for your voice.
Anyway, that's just my comment for today, and I thank you for taking my call.
Yes, thank you for your comment. Mm-hmm.
I like to suggest for those who are concerned about some of the things that our caller was just saying, those of you in Oregon, check out the group that's working for a single-payer health care plan that moves us in the direction of not only our Scandinavian neighbors, but our neighbor to the north and our neighbor to the south. Health care for all. It's an organization working here in Oregon for a renewed and different way of how we deliver medical services.
All right. So I'm glad we were able to get a good conversation going. I do want to remind people, though, that it takes it takes all of us to not only make the changes that we need in society, but support the efforts that others are making to make the changes that we need in society. You know what Gandhi has said, you know, be the change, be the change. And here's a way you can be the change on a local level, okay? You are currently, right now, either tuned in real time and listening, or listening to the podcast, and I'm speaking to future listeners, to KBOO Community Radio. Okay, we need you to help us reach our Give Guide fundraising goal. We're trying to reach $50,000. And I know this is a time of austerity. We've just been talking about the stimulus check, the AKA the stingy check. But here's the thing. When you can donate to KBOO on Give Guide, every dollar you donate goes directly to KBOO and helps us reach that $50,000 goal. So support us as volunteer-powered radio by donating at kboo.fm/give, okay? That's kboo.fm/give. And here's the thing. While we do have amounts that we ask for memberships and for those who are able, we do appreciate those who can be sustaining donors. Any amount you give matters. Any amount you give matters. So next week we'll be back on here. Cecil will be taking a little time off. I'll be flying solo. But we ask you to stay tuned, connect to your community radio, KBOO FM, and here, let's have some more talk radio.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9.